to the News Magazine on the America Out Loud Network. I'm Alana Friedman, and this is The Friedman Report. Welcome to the News Magazine on the America Out Loud Network. I'm Alana Friedman, and this is The Friedman Report. The big story this week that just about eclipsed every other story that was in the news was the death of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of ISIS, and one of the most brutal, ugly, vicious, and dangerous men on the planet. Al-Baghdadi was tracked down by Delta Force and Army Rangers with Army bomb-sniffing dogs at his heels, and he ran into an unfinished tunnel that turned out to be a dead end. A wall. He ended his life, in addition, and that of three of his children, whom he dragged with him, by detonating a suicide vest. There were 70 operators in this action, 8 helicopters, and fighters and drones to provide aerial support. It took weeks of planning and training, and it went off without a hitch. In the end, this monster of a man who took pleasure in inflicting the most horrible pain on others, who was the spiritual and operational leader of ISIS, he died running away like the coward and the murderer that he was. And this is the story that I want to start our show off with because it is so important. Al-Baghdadi was a product of his times. When he became the leader of ISIS, the world was a forgiving place. The Arab Spring, which began in Tunisia in 2011 and spread throughout the Middle East, became a turning point for many countries throughout the region. The Arab Spring had set the stage for a larger presence of the Arab world in international affairs. Barack Obama was president of the United States then, and he set the tone for the rest of the world. And his agenda included an embrace of Muslim countries throughout the world. He supported the Arab Spring. For example, when Libya's government under Muammar Gaddafi fell, and Gaddafi himself was murdered, it was the State Department that helped to craft its new constitution. And on the first page of that constitution was the statement that the country would be governed under Islamic law, or Sharia. Throughout the Middle East, one country after another was heavily impacted by what seemed to be spontaneous uprisings from the people. And these uprisings, in some cases, overturned governments. But the Arab Spring ended up centralizing in Syria because, unlike in other countries, the war that developed from the popular uprising lasted and lasted. And this is where ISIS came into the picture. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi became the leader of ISIS in 2010. He distinguished himself with inhuman cruelty and viciousness. The Syrian civil war, which began a year after al-Baghdadi took over, created a perfect opening for his organization to expand its operations and to consolidate its power. Now, there were a number of terrorist groups proliferating through Syria. At one point, there were 32 of them, as far as we could tell. And it was an opportunity that al-Baghdadi could not resist. So while it had been the group's original aim to establish a caliphate in Iraq, the opportunity for expansion from Iraq into Syria became overwhelming. And we began seeing photographs of slaughters of men, women, and children throughout Syria. At first, these massacres were blamed on the Syrian president, Bashar Assad, and his army. But over time, we began to see a pattern that we began to connect to al-Baghdadi's terrorist organization. Christians, Alawites, Shia Muslims, and other minorities were targeted. Women and children were raped and murdered, and men were systematically shot, beheaded, or crucified. These were the early hallmarks of ISIS. At first, the group hid under the umbrellas of other terrorist organizations. But over time, they began to reveal themselves, and as they became increasingly involved in the Syrian war, their mission changed from just operating there to actually taking control of Sunni-majority areas in northern Syria. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi himself, there's very little known about him. We know, for example, that his real name was Ibrahim Awad Ibrahim Ali Mohammed al-Badri al-Samari. He was a highly educated scholar of Islam. He held a PhD in Islamic jurisprudence, and he wore a black turban, which is supposed to signify that he was a direct descendant of Muhammad. Well, did you know that in 2004, al-Baghdadi was arrested by American forces near Fallujah in Iraq? And he was imprisoned in Camp Buka near the city of Basra in southern Iraq. He was released, however, at the end of that same year because the State Department considered him to be a, quote, low-level prisoner, unquote. Well, that mistake was a colossal one. Al-Baghdadi made the most of his time at Camp Buka. He was considered to be a low-risk prisoner, so he was allowed to go anywhere he wanted in the camp, although many of the other prisoners were not. Many of the alumni of Camp Buka, in fact, played a very important roles in leadership positions in ISIS. It took the State Department 7 years to recognize its mistake, and eventually they posted an award of up to $10 million for information leading to the location, arrest, and conviction of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who by then had declared his caliphate and was leader of ISIS. So he was named a designated global terrorist, and he was listed as a terrorist by the United Nations Security Council. But by then, he had gone underground, and he was well on his way to building his power base. And then on June 29th, 2014, just 10 years after he had been imprisoned by the Americans, ISIS produced a video which was distributed online. And in this video, ISIS spokesman Abu Muhammad al-Adnani announced the creation of the caliphate and the appointment by the Shura Council of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi to be caliph for all Muslims everywhere. And he said that this would be called the Islamic State. Now, by this time, al-Baghdadi had officially established his headquarters in the city of Raqqa in northern Syria. Within months of announcing the new caliph and the new caliphate, ISIS opened a second front and they captured a huge area of northern Iraq. One of the most dramatic things that happened during this march into Iraq was that when ISIS came upon the city of Mosul, their whole operation changed. And how did this happen? Well, they came into Mosul, 1,000 men strong. And in the face of these fierce ISIS fighters, the Iraqi military presence of 30,000 men who were supposed to defend the city ran away. They left their weapons, as well as huge stores of U.S. vehicles, including a fleet of 2,300 Humvees that were valued at $1 billion, 40 M1A1 main battle tanks, 74,000 machine guns, and 50 howitzer mobile gun systems. These had all been left behind by American troops when they left. They were left behind for the Iraqi army. ISIS also broke into the central bank and carted off $42 million worth of gold bullion and cash. ISIS, in one day, went from being one of the most impoverished terrorist organizations to the richest terrorist group in the world. Now, this happened on June 10th, 2014. So when the caliphate was announced on June 29th, Mosul had made ISIS very rich and very powerful. Now, something else happened here, and it's noteworthy and very sad, in fact, because ISIS continued its conquest in the vehicles they had just stolen. Long columns of stolen Humvees could be seen all over northern Iraq and northern Syria, and as far away as Aleppo, Syria, which is 250 miles away. My question at the time, as I saw videos of these columns of tanks and fighters and pictures of them celebrating and shouting and cheering, and I said, where are our planes? Where are our fighter jets? Why aren't they taking them out? They would be so easy to pick off. But our fighter jets never showed up. Although they were a prime target, the long columns of tanks and military vehicles were left alone. I have to tell you, in my opinion, this was the worst mistake that the Obama administration made with relation to ISIS. They could have stopped ISIS dead in its tracks, but they didn't. And so ISIS went on to commit horrendous atrocities in the name of Allah, and we did nothing to stop them when we could have. Another thing that ISIS did that, had we stopped them, could have been completely avoided was that in August of 2014, 2 months later, al-Baghdadi's army launched an attack against the Yazidi city of Sinjar. That's in northern Iraq. And it was on a mountain. Over 5,000 Yazidis were murdered, and another 50,000 were able to escape. But thousands of Yazidi women and even little girls were captured for the sex slave market. There was an article in ISIS's slick English magazine, Dabiq. And in this article, they explained it this way. Quote, after capture, the Yazidi women and children were then divided, according to the Sharia, amongst the fighters of the Islamic State who participated in the Sinjar operations. After 1/5 of the slaves were transferred to the Islamic State's authority. So the leaders of ISIS get the best, most beautiful, the youngest, etc. And the fighters get the next pick. And he went on, the article goes on to say, one should remember that enslaving the families of the kuffar, which means infidels, and taking their women as concubines is a firmly established aspect of the Sharia. Unquote. This, my friends, is organized, legitimized rape in the name of Allah. In fact, there were stories that came out of these rape halls where the girls were kept and were raped at the pleasure of the fighters who came in as they wished and picked the women and girls that they wanted. And the stories were that before raping them, they would pray, as if this were some sort of holy thing that they were doing in the name of their religion. Disgusting. What we need to grasp here is that all of the horrendous crimes that ISIS committed were based one way or another on their religious ideology that goes back to the practice of Sharia, which is Islamic law, and the Quran. In fact, ISIS fighters justified all of their barbaric practices with reference to Sharia. Al-Baghdadi himself had sex slaves, including an American, 26-year-old Kayla Mueller, who had been a U.S. aid worker but was captured in northern Syria and became the sex slave of al-Baghdadi, who raped her constantly and repeatedly until she was killed in February 2015. So this is the man who was killed on Saturday night by our Delta Force and Texas Rangers and bomb-sniffing dogs. He was running, scared. According to the president, he was whimpering and crying. And in the end, when he couldn't go any further, he blew himself up with a suicide vest. The man was grotesquely brutal, even in his final moments. He couldn't just go by himself, but he had to take three children with him. He was a monster, a man with no feelings, a man without human compassion, who reveled in his cruelty and that of his fighters, a man who inflicted pain for his own pleasure. I have no pity for him. I have an image of him, though, expecting to see 70 beautiful virgins in paradise, but standing at the gates of hell and wondering, what am I doing here? Where are my virgins? But all he sees is Satan. Okay, I'm going to take a short break now, but I'll be right back and talk a little bit about the reaction of Americans to this heroic event by members of our armed forces who carried out this plan flawlessly, and by our president who had the courage to order this action. Don't go away. I'll be right back.
Hello, this is Lieutenant Randy Sutton, the host of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. I am a 34-year police veteran. I am also the founder and CEO of an organization that stands behind injured and disabled law enforcement officers. It is called The Wounded Blue. Our website is thewoundedblue.org. We have produced a film. It is an important film. I urge you to watch it. The film details what happens when a police officer or law enforcement officer is shot or stabbed or beaten or disabled, seriously injured in the line of duty. Most people think they are taken care of medically and financially. The reality may be quite different. It is called The Wounded Blue, Service, Sacrifice, Betrayed. The film is available on Amazon, iTunes, and the Microsoft Store.
So here we are again with some stories about the American reaction to this extraordinary event. The taking out of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi followed only a few hours later by the killing of his second in command will go down in history as one of the major defeats of terrorism and tyranny, and a victory for the free world. The events, as they were reported, contained heroism, cowardice, and murder. And the response from many Americans was one of rejoicing that this murderous monster of a man who didn't have the courage to die alone and killed his own children with his suicide bomb, now he was dead. And now this horrible monster who brought pain and suffering to so many thousands of people was gone forever. And so was his second in command, who was killed in a U.S. airstrike only a few hours later. It was a reason for Americans and people everywhere to rejoice. But in America, not everyone took the news well. There was also criticism, ridicule, and the most ridiculous responses from people who considered themselves enemies of the president. But wait a minute. This man was an enemy of the people. He was ready to kill every American. if he could. His death is cause for celebration. The world is a safer place now. So why aren't all Americans celebrating the way they did when, under Obama's presidency, Osama bin Laden was killed in his lair? Well, it's interesting, because the Democrats are so infused with their own hatred for President Donald Trump that there is nothing that he can do that they will applaud, that they will accept as being something positive. And the interesting thing is this. The death of Osama bin Laden was very personal to Americans. He was the one who was responsible for 9/11. It was his people who carried out the attacks. It was his people who made that happen and who took the lives of over 3,000 people, those who died on the scenes and those who died afterwards from the effects of working at Ground Zero. And the response from the American people after it was revealed that Osama bin Laden had been killed was overwhelmingly in support of the president and his courage in authorizing this attack. The SEALs got their due respect, but Obama received the credit for authorizing the attack, as well he should have. Only today, with a Republican president, with Donald Trump in the White House, it's different. To be sure, as I've said, 9/11 was personal to Americans. It was an attack against our country. And ISIS somehow maybe seems a little bit more remote. And yet, although it was personal, the death toll was relatively low compared to the huge number of deaths for which ISIS was responsible. Consider this. The death toll from ISIS far exceeded what we experienced on 9/11. ISIS killed tens of thousands of people. They killed wherever they went and left a trail of death behind them in northern Iraq and Syria. This was not just a massacre. It was genocide. So this was a victory of massive proportions. And the death of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi will go down in history as one of the major defeats for terrorism in the history of civilization. So what about the ridicule and the criticism of President Trump's decision to launch this attack? What exactly did they say? Well, the one that got the most attention was the headline on the Washington Post for Sunday. You know, the Washington Post is known to be a left-wing publication, part of the mainstream media, part of the fake news, part of the press that on a good day stretches the truth, and on a less good day, plain out lies. But this headline, this took the cake. It was an obituary for Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. It was a very long obituary. And it covered his entire life, some of it in very glowing terms. But the highlight of the obituary was the headline. It got so much criticism that it didn't stay up for long. What exactly did they say? Well, the headline said this. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, austere religious scholar at helm of Islamic State, dies at 48. That's it. That was the headline. Very plain vanilla. This was just a young guy who died prematurely. He was a scholar. He was a scholar. He had a PhD in Islamic jurisprudence. And I guess maybe that did make him a scholar. But that had nothing to do with the man that we killed, that our soldiers killed in that tunnel. He was a rapist, a serial rapist, and a murderer, and a monster who deserved to die in the most awful ways possible, because that's what he subjected his victims to do. He burned them alive, or he cut off their heads, or he crucified them. He was not a nice man. He was not a man who deserved a formal, cordial obituary that mentioned in passing that he was also a terrorist. Incredible. Well, let's take a look at what some of the others in the large cast of characters are saying. Let's take Joe Biden, for example, former Vice President of the United States and now a candidate for president. He's running against a whole array of other Democrats vying for the same position, and he hopes to be running against President Trump, although that's looking increasingly doubtful. Anyway, here's what he said. He said, quote, "I'm glad President Trump ordered the mission, but as more details of the raid emerge, it's clear that this victory was not due to Donald Trump's leadership. It happened despite his ineptitude as commander-in-chief," unquote. Is he kidding? Does he have any idea what he's talking about? He said, quote, "His erratic behavior," talking about Trump, "made it harder and more dangerous for the special forces to carry it out. And they had to fly through territory that is now hostile to the United States, taking fire along the way, including territory we controlled just weeks ago," unquote. The only thing is, I'm not sure that he knows what he's talking about. The United States had informed the Russians and others that they would be flying through and warned them not to interfere, which they did not. Our planes did take fire, but it wasn't from any of the operations that we had any influence on. It was from al-Nusra fighters. These are terrorists operating in Syria, and they'll fire at anything that moves. Joe Biden is dead wrong. Because, as you know, everything that the president did worked. It worked because he had an excellent team to carry out the operation, and he had the courage to authorize the attack. That's not a failure, that's a success. Sorry, Joe. Now, Mayor Pete Buttigieg tweeted, quote, "This is a blow against ISIS and an important step in the fight against stateless terrorism. Credit should go to all who were involved, above all to the brave Americans in uniform and intelligence professionals who risked their lives to complete this mission. Today we honor them," unquote. You'll notice that he doesn't mention the president at all. Julian Castro, another candidate for president on the Democrat side, wrote, quote, "A ruthless murderer has been brought to justice. I'm grateful to our military and intelligence community. Their courage and dedication inspire us all. Abandoning our Syrian and Kurdish partners remains a disastrous decision that will make the fight against ISIS harder," unquote. So he praises the servicemen who carried out the operation and slams President Trump, who authorized it. More of the same. Tulsi Gabbard wrote, quote, "Thank you and congratulations to our special operations forces and others involved in tracking and getting rid of ISIS leader Baghdadi. But as we have learned with the death of Osama bin Laden, whose organization Al-Qaeda is now stronger than ever, ISIS will continue due to the short-sighted policies of Trump, including his support for Erdogan and Saudi Arabia, which helps spread the extremist ideology that acts as the fuel for ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and others. As president, I will end all such support," unquote. So in her congratulations for the troops that carried out this attack, she also manages to get an election pitch in there, and included the obligatory bashing of the president. Beto O'Rourke tweeted, quote, "Last night, our special forces brought the leader of one of history's most destructive terrorist groups to justice. Let's thank our service members for their courage and recommit to protecting all of the allies who are working with us to defeat ISIS, including the Kurds," quote. That last is supposed to be a slam at the president, who is accused of abandoning the Kurds. And Bernie Sanders tweeted, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi was a murderer and a terrorist responsible for terrible suffering and death. The fight against ISIS would not be possible without the brave efforts of the Kurds and other U.S. allies. Unquote. Nothing about the president in there. And finally, Senator Elizabeth Warren tweeted, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi led a campaign of mass violence and terror that devastated the region and threatened the world. His death is a setback for ISIS and a victory for justice. I am grateful for the skill and courage of our special operations and intelligence professionals. Baghdadi's death closes one chapter, but it is not the end of our fight against terrorism. Unquote. There are others, but I think these are the highlights. And the interesting thing here is that all these candidates are, only one of them mentioned Trump, and that was in the negative, and the others simply ignored him. What they failed to recognize or to acknowledge was that it would not have happened had he not had the courage to authorize it. Now let's go to some of the political leaders on the Democrat side and see what they have to say. Nancy Pelosi made a statement in which she applauded, quote, the heroism, dedication, and skill of our military and our intelligence professionals and acknowledged the work of our partners in the region. Well, I could go on and read you more. There are plenty more. But you get the idea. The Democrats are so consumed with hate for the president that they just cannot bring themselves to say something nice about him. And in this case, there's a lot to be said because it was the president who authorized this operation. Without him, it would not have gone forward. And it took courage to do that because not everybody agrees with a president who wants to launch this kind of very dangerous operation, no matter how well planned it is, and no matter how certain the outcome. Now, Nancy Pelosi had something else to say about the raid. She was angry because she had not been informed about it before it happened. She should have been. That was the protocol. But this is a lady who doesn't seem to care about protocol, and in this case, the president was concerned about the intelligence about the raid leaking, creating a dangerous situation for the team involved. She was not informed, nor was Adam Schiff, for the same reason. He's a notorious leaker. This is what she said. The House must be briefed on this raid, which the Russians, but not top congressional leadership, were notified of in advance, and on the administration's overall strategy in the region. Unquote. She's slamming the president because he did not read her and the head of the Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff, into the operation before it took place. And she wonders why. She thinks that it was wrong to do that. But she forgets, or maybe she just doesn't want to remember, that the president has good reason not to trust them, either of them, because they have leaked sensitive information and because they have been fighting him tooth and nail at every opportunity since he became president. In an operation like this, trust is absolutely essential because the lives of our soldiers depend on it. I remember one Christmas when there was a threat that the government would shut down, and the president stayed in the White House throughout the Christmas and New Year's vacation in order to be available to the Democrats to negotiate and come up with a solution that would keep the government from shutting down. But Nancy Pelosi never showed up. Instead, she went to Hawaii to a spa hotel, and she didn't come back until after New Year's. Opportunity lost. So here we have the most extraordinary military operation, special operation, to take out the most notorious, brutal, vicious terrorist in the world today. And the Democrats cannot find it in themselves to congratulate the president who authorized the raid. Shame on them. This is a reflection of how far down a very dangerous path we have come in America. The bitterness, the anger, the rage, the hatred that the Democrats feel for the Republicans has poisoned every aspect of our lives today. Thank God Donald Trump had the courage to authorize this attack. Thank God Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi is dead and can no longer plague the innocent victims of his demented mind. And God bless Donald Trump for making it happen. Well, I've had enough of serious stuff. How about you? I'm going to take a short break, but I'll be right back with something a little lighter, beginning with, you just can't make this stuff up. So don't go away. I'll be right back.
It's your news and entertainment network. News blogs, informative podcasts, entertaining videos, or listen to 24/7 talk radio on our free apps on Apple, Android, or Alexa. We the people, AmericaOutloud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount or call 844-869-9958.
Well, my friends, now it's time for You Just Can't Make This Stuff Up. And we're going to go back to California again. It seems always that we're either in California or outside the offices of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, or one of her squad members. But for today, I want to tell you about Prospector Pete. Do you know who he is? In 1967, a student named Ben Barker sculpted a bronze statue of a prospector. The statue was later named Prospector Pete, and ultimately became the mascot, Prospector Pete. Now, what's the story with Prospector Pete? Well, he's the mascot for California State University, Long Beach. Well, at least he used to be. But now, the university is asking students to vote on a new mascot because Prospector Pete, it seems, is offensive to indigenous people. Now, it is true that indigenous people in California suffered mightily at the hands of the white settlers who came from the east. And over a period from 1846 to 1900, it is reported that 130,000 indigenous people were killed because of the migration from the east to the Golden State. So this is a bitter history, but I'm not sure I understand the connection between Prospector Pete and the overall history of California. Now, I have a problem with people who want to rewrite history, or ignore it altogether, or change it in some way. There's an old saying attributed to George Santayana, the author, and it goes something like, "Those who refuse to learn from history are destined to repeat it." Now, I am not saying that we're going to repeat the Gold Rush, or that we're going to repeat the early days of this country when we didn't have the sensitivities that we have now to people who were different from us. But I want to tell you that I find this little drama disturbing. On the one hand, the fact that the Gold Rush is offensive to indigenous people, it's hard for me to wrap my head around that, because it was just part of our history. They found gold out west, and people came to harvest it, to find it, to dig it out of the ground, or to flush it out of the streams. But people were cruel. There are cruel people among us. There are unkind people among us, people who hurt other people. We read about it in the newspapers every day. But it doesn't mean that we should scrub our history, because our history is important. It's what shows us where we have been, and it helps point us in the direction of where we should go. So to take away the mascot of a school who has nothing to do with race, who has nothing to do with anything but digging for gold. And some of the people who came to dig for gold were pretty nasty people. But that doesn't mean we should erase the history that they represent. Look, I understand about national pride and a history of national loss, great national loss. I lost a lot of family in the Holocaust. So I understand it. I feel it. And a day doesn't go by when I don't think about the people I never knew. But in spite of that, I don't want to erase the history of the Holocaust. We need to remember it so it doesn't happen again. And the same thing is true with American history. There were very bad pieces of American history, things I'm ashamed of as an American. But it doesn't mean that I should scrub it and forget it and pretend it never happened, because then we will never learn from it. So I couldn't make this thing up. I couldn't make up this story. It's too bizarre. We're seeing a lot of it today, though. People who want to tear down statues of the Confederate officers and soldiers. People who want to forget that slavery existed and scrub that from our history books. And the men who built this country, who, as it happened, owned slaves because that was the nature of the times. It was horrible. One man owning another man. It's unbelievably horrible. It's awful. But it's part of our history, and it helps us to formulate the direction that we're going in. So I offer you this. I offer you Prospector Pete as a story that you just can't make up. They're going to take down the statue, and they're now having a vote on what kind of mascot, if any, they will have at the university. Guess what they're considering? Pelicans, sharks, stingrays, giraffes, a kraken, or even picking the option that is called the beach, which is actually no mascot at all. How silly can you get? A giraffe? A kraken? You just can't make this stuff up. Now, here's an interesting story. I think it is. Do you know that in Jerusalem, there is a building, a very ancient building, in which Jesus is believed to have had the Last Supper? Now, as some of you know, I used to live in Jerusalem. I lived there for 16 years. And I've been to this room. It's extraordinary. But in this Christian holy site, this building, it's located on the upper floor of King David's tomb complex on Jerusalem's Mount Zion, Har Zion. Now, What archaeologists are doing now, which is so fascinating, is they are using some sophisticated 3D mapping equipment to unlock some of the secrets of this room. It's amazing. The 3D mapping is part of an ongoing project that began 3 years ago. You see, this place, the Old City of Jerusalem, is holy to three religions: Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And it's very sensitive. You can't just carry out archaeological excavations willy-nilly, because in doing one thing, in uncovering one archaeological find, you can destroy another. And you can also offend the religious sensibilities of a group other than the one you are digging up. So, in order to find out more about this room, the archaeologist created a team of experts from the Institute for Modern and Contemporary Archaeological Research in Austria and the Cyprus Archaeological Institution, and altogether they arranged to conduct 3D laser scans of the room. They mapped every corner that they could reach. They could penetrate stone and create accurate models of that interior space. In one of the rooms, they revealed an Agnus Dei, or Lamb of God, symbol. On a stone, a keystone, a carved lion symbol is also visible using this technology. The lion was the symbol of King David, and according to the Bible, Jesus was a descendant of King David. This scanning is going to reveal secrets that have been hidden for over two centuries. The other interesting thing about this is that this site is layered. Each conquering army brought with it a civilization that built its churches, its mosques, on top of the whatever had been there before. And so you have a 4th century Byzantine church, a Crusader's church built on top of that, and so forth. And this gives you a wealth of information about the history of this part of the world, the history of Jerusalem. And this new 3D scanning will reveal all of these things that have been hidden for so long. The Crusader church was originally decorated with architectural symbols. You didn't need to speak Latin if you were a Christian pilgrim. You just needed to be able to read the symbols. So this is very, very interesting, and we'll have to see what happens with it. I'm sure that it won't be a secret, because they're very proud of their work. Now, while there is no clear evidence from an archaeological standpoint that the room that I described to you before was the site of Jesus' Last Supper, which, for those of you who know, was the Passover Seder, they're going to continue to use their laser scans of the walls and the complex so that they hope that maybe in the future they will be able to find evidence that this was in fact the room. In the meantime, it is a site for pilgrims to go to and believe that they are standing in the room where Jesus and his disciples had their Last Supper. Now, we have a few minutes left, and I'd like to do something a little different right now. I'd like to take a quick trip around the country and pick up some of the stories that are happening just in the last few days in various parts of the country. We can start in California. California is on fire, and the fires are huge. The winds are fierce, and they are causing absolute havoc. In one case, a strong wind broke a large branch onto a power line that created a spark that ignited some brush and caused the Getty Fire. This fire has already destroyed dozens of homes and caused thousands of people to evacuate. This fire is in Los Angeles, and it has already burned more than 650 acres. As of Tuesday night, it was only 15% contained. But with these fierce winds, they travel and they spread fast. And it's amazing to me. I spoke to somebody who lives in Los Angeles today, and she was telling me that she's just going about her business. It's not really affecting her. It would affect me, I think. I think I'd be concerned to see these fires are just huge and menacing and terrifying. One fire was gaining ground to the tune of approximately the size of a football field every hour. Many people have already lost their homes, and some may have lost their lives. And yet, if you speak to people who live in the cities who are not near the fires, like my friend, life goes on as usual. Nothing is happening that is giving them concerns. And so it goes. California is a large state. It's one of the largest in the country. But it is burning now. There are parts that are burning fiercely, and the fires are large, and some of them are growing because it's just impossible to put them all out. Let's go to South Carolina, where Joe Biden went to church on Sunday morning, and Father Robert Morey of St. Anthony's Catholic Church in Florence, South Carolina, was reported to have refused to give Joe Biden sacrament because of the politician's support of abortion. Biden claims that he is personally against abortion, but he has gone on record to support Roe v. Wade. He has recently said that he supports Medicaid-funded abortions as well. He said, quote, "I made sure we guaranteed a woman's right to choose for a better part of a generation. I would make sure that we move and insist that we codify Roe v. Wade. The public is already there. Things have changed," unquote. Well, it's not clear, because there are many of us out there who do not believe that abortion is a proper procedure because the life of an unborn baby is precious and should not be destroyed. So the whole country is not with him, but he does have a following, and it seems quite possible that the Supreme Court will at some point be again taking up this issue. Now, you know, this happened also to Nancy Pelosi in 2013. Then the Vatican said that Nancy Pelosi should be denied communion until her policy changed. That was shocking that the Pope would get involved. But we are in a situation now in this country where we are very much at odds with each other on some very serious issues. And abortion, or the right to life, is one of these issues, and we are going to have to resolve it soon, and I think we will. So that's another story. That was South Carolina. And in Washington, Congress is getting ready to vote on an impeachment inquiry, a formal impeachment inquiry. It's funny because it was only a few weeks ago when Nancy Pelosi stood up and said, "I am declaring that we are initiating a formal impeachment inquiry." And she refused to call for a vote of the full Congress. She said it wasn't necessary. And they went into secret sessions. Remember, we've talked about that. So all of a sudden now, it's urgent. It looks like things are getting very dicey for the Democrats, as the Inspector General's report will be coming out soon. And it has already been reported that the investigation is changing into a criminal investigation. And that is very serious, and it may be that a lot of senior officials on the Democrat side will be charged or indicted for crimes that they committed against this administration or just against the law during the Obama administration. And it may be that some of the heads that are about to roll include names like Strzok and Page and Mueller, like Clapper, Brenner, Comey, Clinton, and maybe even Obama. So we'll see. This is going to be very interesting. And so there's a combination of the vote on Thursday to investigate the possibility of impeaching the president, and hopefully the release of the Inspector General's report on the deep state. So we'll see about that. Now, here's another quick note that Big Pharma, all the pharmaceutical companies who advertise on television now, have been doing it for years, but they may have to televise their drug prices if the bill is passed. I think it's a great idea, and I hope it happens. It's long overdue. Well, thank you for spending this hour with me. I always enjoyed this hour we spend together because we talk about such interesting things. I hope you enjoyed the show this week, and I hope I'll see you back here next week when I'll have more stories about what's been going on during the week that just passed. You've been listening to News Magazine on the America Out Loud Network. I'm Alana Friedman, and this has been The Friedman Report.